all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Dr. Mark Moyer. Dr. Moyer is a professor at Hillsdale College. He is also the director of the college's Center for Military History and Strategy. He has had a fascinating academic career. He got his BA from Harvard, but he got his PhD from Cambridge. He went on and taught as a professor at the University of Marine Corps University. He taught at Texas A&M University, the Foreign Service Institute. He was a senior fellow at the Joint Special Operations University and has worked as a consultant on senior leadership of Special Operations Joint Task Force for Afghanistan. These all weave into the many, many things he's written on that we could talk about. There's just no way we can get to it all. He's written on Vietnam. He's written on special operations. He's talked about issues that have, administrations that have gone awry in working with the military. And his most recent book is Masters of Corruption, How the Federal Bureaucracy Sabotaged the Trump Presidency. So lots of things to talk about, but Mark, thanks for taking some time to talk to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, great to be talking to you and the veteran community.
Well, you've got, as I say, an interesting background academically as a historian, but having worked, if you will, inside the government and now outside at Hillsdale College, and I think you're a member of the Hoover Institute Working Group on the Role of Military History in Contemporary Conflict. So you're thinking about a lot of these issues. And kind of one of them I wanted to start with is this whole idea of what really is the interplay between civilian oversight and military operations from a historical perspective?
Yes, well, this is something that dates back to our nation's founding. And one of the things I've enjoyed about being at Hillsdale is we actually make sure everybody understands well where we've come from. But the founders recognized something that actually didn't really become more generally known until Clausewitz in the 19th century, but that war itself is a political undertaking, and therefore you ought to have political leadership ultimately responsible. And so we have vested in President the authority of Commander-in-Chief with the military reporting to the Commander-in-Chief, and now that then requires a lot of interplay between the president and the military, and ideally the president should be very well versed in military affairs, and of course Washington was, and most of our presidents who have been successful commanders, Lincoln being another great example, FDR, you know, understood the military. Now when you get to Vietnam and Lyndon Johnson, you run into trouble because you have a commander-in-chief who doesn't understand the military. So that is one of the big problems we've had since Vietnam is military, a president's lacking the military knowledge they need. You know, Barack Obama is another one who, you know, I wrote a book about him, a similar problem. And so this interplay should require presidents who know the military.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I think we'd all agree with the concept, but it's how it actually works in real life where the rub comes in. And you've been inside special operations, you've taught at Marine Corps University, and sort of talked to future leaders about that interplay, I suppose, that not every president, not every political leader really has a good set of guiding principles or understanding of how to use the military and how to impact foreign policy. You wrote Strategic Failure kind of talking about, you know, somebody who didn't really have that going in. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, and yeah, I think we see with Obama a lot of the same problems we saw with LBJ. I think we're also seeing with Biden is this lack of understanding. But part of this too relates to what the president's priorities are. And we saw that we have some presidents who are very domestically focused, and basically for them, foreign policy is a nuisance that gets in the way of their domestic agenda. And so they tend to be reactive. And that was what happened with Johnson. He was not proactive. He didn't have a proactive strategy. He was trying to remake the country through the Great Society, and Vietnam was this pesky thing. And so he would react as problems arose, but that's not really a good way to manage the strategy of the world's biggest power or the military, because you want to be proactive and moving. And we saw the same thing with Obama. I think we're seeing it again with Biden. So it takes a lot of effort by the president and interest to actually have a more proactive approach, to actually have a strategy, because the idea of sort of reaction and crisis management, which and Bill Clinton was another one who fits in this category, you know, that is very passive, and it leaves you vulnerable to your enemies.
Does the strategy that a president should create come simply out of his view or her view of the world, of foreign affairs, of domestic policy? Where and who should be putting input into this as you've studied it, those who've been successful and those who've not? Where does the input for developing that policy come from?
You know, the president should have a strong set of advisors who can help him understand the key issues. And we've seen here, too, a range of people and qualifications. You know, Robert McNamara is probably the poster child for the Secretary of Defense, who was ill prepared for his job and gave a lot of bad advice to the president. In fact, LBJ finally by 1968 figures out that McNamara has really not been doing a good job and ends up letting him go. You know, we've had other people, you know, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who was in second Bush and then also spent some time in the Obama administration. I think he was someone who was much more effective, but he ends up having a big falling out with Obama and believes Obama deceived him. He wrote a long book about it. And then you also have the uniformed military who weigh in on these issues. And we see some presidents are much more willing to listen to what they have to say. Others are very dismissive. We saw with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Vietnam War that the president, especially Johnson and also McNamara, didn't pay attention to them and what they were saying. And in hindsight, we can see they were actually recommending a much better strategy than the one the civilians were we're pursuing. Now, of course, the generals aren't always right, but I think they should get greater respect than they sometimes get. And we also saw this in the Clinton administration, the Obama administration, and we know we also saw in the Trump administration some cases where there was this conflict between the uniformed military or lack of respect, and the Trump administration, it certainly went both ways, where we saw what appeared to be General Mark Milley, verging on insubordination towards the White House.
Yeah, Trump said horrible things about the military, and he said good things about the military. That whipsawing has got to drive people crazy as well. But you have taken a lot of time to look at the issue of the Vietnam War through a historian's lens. You know, decades and decades later, you've written Triumph Regained and Triumph Forsaken, which tells me there's one more coming out. That is trying to reimagine or reposition the Vietnam War and strip away from it sort of the 1968 domestic problems. Tell us, when you relook at the Vietnam War, if it was winnable or if it was just from the get-go not so and politics prevailed.
Yeah, so the reason I got so involved in studying Vietnam is that at the time I was going through college, this was the early 90s, the Vietnam War was widely derided by the American intelligentsia as this unwinnable conflict. We should never have been in it. And the Vietnam veterans were maligned in part for their participation in that war. And so as I started reading about it, it occurred to me that so much of what the intelligentsia, the journalists and historians were telling us was factually incorrect, and that it appeared to be guided by motives other than getting to the truth, such as justifying why we protested against the war or refused to serve in the military during Vietnam. And so Triumph Forsaken, which goes up to 63, I originally was going to do one volume on the whole war, but as I got into it, I realized there's an amazing amount of information that hasn't been shared with the public, and it causes us to fundamentally rethink how the war came about. And so that book, Triumph Forsaken, goes up to July of 1965, and in that period, where the U.S. is not yet committed to the war, we see now, and with the benefit of a lot of new sources, especially from the North Vietnamese side, that the outcome was far from foreordained. In fact, the U.S. was doing pretty well up until 63, when we participated in a disastrous coup. But even after that, the North Vietnamese were still very wary of going to war. And so it was Lyndon Johnson, through a series of misstatements, particularly the statement that we're not going to fight, send our American boys to fight in Vietnam, and various other acts of weakness that really invite the North Vietnamese to come into the war. And then we also have lots of information now saying that other strategies, including invading North Vietnam or cutting the Ho Chi Minh Trail, could have given us a different outcome.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you get the other guy's perspective, too. You say the sources from Vietnam shed a whole new light on this, because you now know how they're reacting to your action and vice versa. But I wanted to ask about, come back to the president's role in setting military direction and policy, and that the president should have a strategy for how to use the military. And in your writings, It seems like as new items, new approaches develop, maybe the presidential strategies don't embrace them timely. One is the concept of counterinsurgency. Another is, how do you use special operations? And then, like, technological advances, drones would be a good example of it. How do you, as a historian and academic, as you look at this and you see these kind of advances in warfare, how does it get molded into a current strategy?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. That has been a big challenge in both counterinsurgency and special operations, as you mentioned. And one of the big problems you have is that senior leaders don't necessarily really understand what these things are. We saw this in Iraq and Afghanistan, especially a lot of people throwing around the terms counterterrorism and counterinsurgency without fully understanding what they mean, or people thinking that special operations can do things well beyond what they can actually achieve. There's a lot of mystique around special operations, and sometimes they're seen as a silver bullet. Now, we had the killing of Osama bin Laden by Navy SEALs, which was a major tactical victory, but for one thing, those victories are few and far between, but also we've seen that even if you decapitate or remove the leader, one leader in this network of nefarious actors, usually they're able to replace that person. And especially was an issue in Iraq, where we thought we were going to get, once we got rid of Saddam Hussein and his sons, that the conflict would be over. But it turned out that these insurgents had a lot more staying power, and so you couldn't just use special operations. You had to have conventional military forces to go in and actually solve the problem.
The reason I'm touching on all of these veteran radio listeners, and we're talking to Dr. Mark Moyer, who is the professor at Hillsdale College and the director of the college's Center for Military History and Strategy, is he's written on all of these. He wrote Oppose Any Foe, The Rise of America's Special Operations Forces. He wrote a book called A Question of Command, Counterinsurgency from the Civil War to Iraq. So we're talking about issues that are he's spent a lot of time thinking about. And I want to go back to when you say senior leaders don't always understand. Are you referring to in the military or at the cabinet level, the presidential level, over on the civilian side?
It's usually on the civilian side. I mean, the military officers, you know, they spent their whole careers in the military. So usually, not always, but usually they have a strong appreciation of what the military is actually capable of. But you have oftentimes people on the civilian side who have spent little to no time in the military. And so they don't have that understanding. And you know, once you're president or secretary of defense, you do not have a lot of time to obtain new knowledge. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's important that hopefully you have people in these jobs who already know a lot when they come to the office.
Yeah, I've heard things out of congressional offices were like, oh, we don't need to catch up on the naval fleet or the air fleet with the Chinese because we're going to use autonomous vehicles, drones, air frames, etc. And you sort of go, I don't know if these people know what they're talking about. And that's that we kind of fall in love with finding the silver bullet, don't we? Whether it's technical advances or, well, just send special forces. They're the silver bullet. That's kind of a common civilian problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's certainly been an issue with special operations forces. I mean, that's how Bill Clinton thought he was going to solve Somalia by sending in Delta Force to Somalia. They said Bush initially was hoping they could deal with Saddam Hussein, and then Obama thought we could basically get rid of much of our military because we could rely on these special operations forces. But usually we tend to overestimate the power of these things, and we're seeing this now with new technologies. I mean, people thinking that artificial intelligence is just going to totally change how war is fought. But you know, if you look at what's going on in Ukraine right now, the war there, it actually doesn't look a whole lot different than it used to. I mean, obviously you have new technologies that can be important, but you know, seldom are they going to fundamentally transform the way that wars are fought.
Yeah, I don't think I can have a conversation these days without somebody bringing up AI and how that's going to impact things. And then, as you say, you look at Ukraine, that's just a basic old bloody artillery war sprinkled in with some new technology. So maybe what's old is new as well. So I do have a question that I want you to elaborate on, though, Professor Moyer, and that is this idea that everything the civilian side wants, and I'll say primarily the president wants to get done, gets implemented in a straightforward fashion according with the policy that he's setting out. The federal government doesn't work that way, does it?
Generally not. It depends, too, on how high of a priority the issue is for the president. But even then, we've seen just about every president has complained that some part of the bureaucracy is not doing what he wants, you know, whether it's the State Department or the Defense Department or the Department of Justice. You know, this does tend to be worse with Republicans, I think, because typically the federal bureaucracy largely votes Democrat, and so they tend to be more sympathetic to Democratic presidents. But, you know, a lot of the bureaucracy is, you know, obsessed above all with sort of self-preservation more than anything else. And so you do see oftentimes, and I certainly saw this in my time as a Trump appointee, that agencies will come up with all sorts of tricks do what they want rather than what the White House wants. And you know, have about 4,000 political appointees who are sent to the federal agencies. And I was one of those in the Trump administration. But oftentimes, and in our agency, this is certainly the case, that most of the political appointees don't know the landscape nearly as well. And so career bureaucrats have a lot of different ways they can try to slow things down. They can hide money, and I saw a lot of that. And then again, in the agency where I worked, the Agency for International Development, we had top political appointees who in some cases weren't really interested in coercing the bureaucracy, which is what they're supposed to be there doing, is getting the bureaucracy to do what the White House wants. And so you had a lot of instances where in what the White House wanted was not actually implemented. I think we'll see that change if there's a second Trump administration, because I think they've wised up. But that was certainly a huge problem in the first Trump administration.
And you wrote about those experiences at the U.S. Agency for International Development as a senior political appointee, and sort of the how career federal employees can thwart a president's efforts in your new book, Masters of Corruption, on Encounter Books imprint. Was this as surprising to you when you got inside as it was to maybe somebody like me reading it from the outside?
Yeah, so I had spent time in government before, but not as a political appointee. And I had seen some evidence of corruption in the Department of Defense, where I had spent most of the time before this. But I didn't quite realize how egregious it could be, or the impunity with which a lot of people were acting. So one of the most startling things that happened was that when I approached the human resource authorities, when I first started getting evidence of corruption going on, they said, well, you know, most people here don't report corruption. It's a good thing you are. They didn't fully explain why people didn't report it, but as I later found out, it's that if you report corruption, the bureaucracy is going to attack you. And that's what happened to me. And, you know, I ended up getting fired based on a fraudulent accusation that some of these bureaucrats put forward. Well, meanwhile, the actually corrupt individuals managed to hold on to their jobs.
Yeah, it's an a sad but interesting story, Masters of Corruption. But, you know, bringing you back on, you know, to the point of your role at Hillsdale College, can you tell us what the Center for Military History and Strategy focuses on?
Yeah, so we are focused on a couple things. One is teaching military history to the students here. It's a subject that has been eliminated at nearly all other colleges. I mean, we're about the only place that still has faculty who specialize in military history, and we've set up a minor in military history that students can take as part of their studies. We also hold some big events with major speakers on military history here on campus, and we do open those to outside visitors, and we bring in some distinguished scholars to to bolster our capabilities here. We are looking, I think, eventually to offering graduate degrees. We're still fairly early in developing this center, but over the longer term, that is one of the other things we are contemplating.
I have to say, those who regularly listen to Veterans Radio are interested in military history. I think there's a lot to learn from it, both our mistakes and our successes. And we really do appreciate you spending a little time with us today, Dr. Mark Moyer, over at Hillsdale College. And we'd love to have you back another time.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having me on.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org.
And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We would again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Prescorn Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.